Well, my name's Donald Cox. I lead a wonderful life. I'm in retirement. I have a fairly quiet life. I have two very good friends, one of which, Derek Travers. We go back to being apprentices in the Air Force when we were 15 years of age. I stayed in the Air Force for a while and did a lot of work with some of the jets. They had problems with the Vampire jets. They switched over from bag brakes to disc brakes, and occasionally they had very interesting situations. The jets occasionally could land, the oleos wouldn't collapse, and then when they put the brakes on, the legs would be doing this as they went down the runway. It was all very, very interesting.
So where was that when you were working?
That was at Aeronautical Research Labs.
In Melbourne.
In Melbourne, yep. And I was there for quite some time. We did a lot of wind tunnel work. Especially, now, that rings another bell. One of the aircraft in England, they had a lot of trouble. They'd get to a particular point like that, and then the aircraft would stall. And we got called in, and they ended up putting across the aircraft wing all little tufts that would show when the air was flowing smoothly over the airfoil and when it wasn't. And that this showed up that at certain situations the airflow would be all over the place, and that's when the plane stalled. So what they did was they fitted a special little humped bit right out on the tip of the aircraft, and that delayed the stall. So there's lots of little things like that that come back to mind, working there with some very interesting people, some very awkward people sometimes. You've no idea how awkward scientists can be when they get a bee in their bonnet.
So when did you start at Aeronautical Research?
Oh, my gosh.
1954, I think.
It would have been about then. It would have been, about 21, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I had a lot of fun at Aeronautical Research Labs. Did a lot of flying in aircraft. Right. I did flying in the Canberras. I had some problems with the Canberra aircraft at one stage. My golly.
And I see some of the Canberras, the American version, are still being used today.
I didn't know that.
High altitude.
High altitude, yeah. No, some of those aircraft were ahead of their time, no doubt about that. And the wind tunnels were marvellous, you know, you could really see what was happening across the airflow across a wing in the wind tunnels. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you were involved in some way with the black box flight recorder, which was...
Dr. Dave Warren,
so
yes.
So he invented...
It was his idea. It started out as a tape recorder, but they found when they did some tests on it that the tape actually impacted and you couldn't recover the data that they wanted. So there were a couple of brothers by the name of Murfield, and these guys were very good at inventing and transferring thoughts into hardware. And they invented a wire recorder that recorded all the stuff on long strands of wire. So, yeah.
So what was recorded on the first flight recorders? Voice or telemetry?
Both. Mm-hmm. Dr. Dave Warren, and you'll pardon me, he did not want to know how anything worked. He just wanted it to work. And then he would be the director,
yes.
And I was the the stagehand that put everything together. So when we went overseas, like to England, to demonstrate the black box to a crowd called Duval, they wanted to build and make these things in England. We went to Duval. It's going back a long while in the memory too. I was there for probably at least 6 or 8 weeks and actually helped with the development of the of that little box. Got a bit involved in the testing, especially when they when we put it onto an aircraft. And, you know, those were times when suddenly something had happened, you'd think, why did that happen? And then someone else would say, well, let's follow that up. And usually something good came out of it, like you could extend the range of what you were using that thing for. And Duval, they had some excellent technicians. These were the guys that used to help build these things and put them together and test them. And they had some excellent technicians. And we went round to a number of the big aircraft factories in England, selling off the black box, pointing out what could be done, what needed to be done, how often these things needed to be maintained, and what happened if you weren't getting the right results. Well, we called in at India on the way over to the UK, and Dave was supposed to demonstrate this. There were 3 scientists, Indian scientists, who met us at the airport, and Dave was supposed to meet us. And Dave, he made a lot of contacts. And then he'd quite often, he'd leave me to do all the talking. And I enjoyed that, you know, a bit of the gift of the gab. But Dave, he was not a salesman, but he knew what he wanted to get across. And he knew the strong points of the equipment. Right. And there were some things I knew a little better than he did, but, you know, you'd put him somewhere and he'd start off. And then he'd say, I'm going to pass this over to Mr. Cox and he can carry on from there. And he'd go off and sit down and enjoy a quiet life while I'm there, perspiring, as it were, thinking, how did I get dumped on again?
So you went to India and that was on the way to
That was on the way to UK. Yeah. We were only there, I think, 2 or 3 days. But, I felt that we achieved a lot there. You know, the people that we met were all interested in what was going on. And aircraft industry was still in its early days in those stages. And things like crash recorders and that, and why planes were crashing,
yes,
and what was happening at the time, and how to fix up things that shouldn't have been happening. So to me, I had a wonderful time in the UK, especially with Duval and the technicians there, and bringing them up to speed on how to service equipment and what to look for and how to get the best out of it. And then we went round, as I said, to all the big aircraft industries, and we were, in effect, selling the recorder. And, you know, that was lots of good memories and lots of happy tummies. No, Dennis Wilshire.
Dennis was the
lead hand.
Yes.
And I got put with the instrumentation side of things. Um,
did you?
I think my best memories of the instrumentation side of things was that the tracking station had basically a false floor.
Oh, yes.
And you could get round under all the racks. The racks were mainly around the perimeter of the control room, but you could get under the racks and get at the wiring.
It had a carpeted floor, didn't it?
Had a carpeted floor and all the rest of it. But it was the cement floor, and it was rather rough on the knees.
Did you get any snakes down there?
No, we had the occasional scorpion, though. But, gee, that's getting back into history, too.
You were running the instrumentation section for a couple of years.
For a couple of years.
And then Dennis Wilshire was moving on. He was going to Aurora Valley.
I think he went to.
Yeah.
And then I took over up there.
As the station director, you were responsible for the whole site, weren't you? Not just
DSS 41, but we had a mini track site there, and we had the Baker Nunn camera, and we had the dreaded lake.
Oh yes,
the lake.
And people had some problems there.
Well. We had people who liked to think that some vehicles could be driven in water. And on three occasions, we had vehicles bogged out just off the lake.
So the crust wasn't that thick?
No. And when they got bogged, we had to get a crane from the village area, which was about a 20-mile, I think we were about 20 miles from a village where the tech area was, and they'd come out and they'd lift these things out of the water, and then they'd dump them. And then the person who had got it bogged had the wonderful job, and it used to take them about 3 days. They'd taken into the village and they had to hose these things down and get everything out. And of course, when they'd settle down in the mud, stuff got into the exhaust system and up into engine bay and everywhere. And it was not a happy job. So we only had three of those things bogged in the middle of the lake. But it provided a lot of fun for the station people. We also had the main, in the cone, in the middle of the dish.
The S-band.
Yes, we had the S-band.
Yeah.
And they had to get the cryogenics up to the dish. And that was one heck of a job. And I also remember one of the other problems we had were the dreaded Gallardi.
Oh, yes, I've heard about those.
The Gallardi were the Galahs. And we had a whole lot of insulation on some of the pipes and stuff around the antenna. And the Galahs used to come in and they'd peck all this stuff up and just drop it. Vroom, clunk, vroom, clunk. Well, in the end, we got a specialist and he said, look, the only way you're going to stop these Galahs getting at this stuff is you're going to have to kill 6 or 7 of them and then hang them around the antenna.
Right.
So that's what we did. And guess what? It worked like a treasure. We never had one, you know, it took about 5 days.
Really?
And after that, we never had any more trouble with the Galahs getting at the antenna and the rest of it. It was just another one of those little learning curves. But, the Galahs were quite a treat. And,
So what was it like living in Wimmera?
It was hell. There were Well, there are three or four senior officers in Woomera, the station director, the area administrator, and the chief technical bloke, and we three. And every so often we'd be called into meetings in the area administrator's office. There'd be something gone wrong, and we had to come up with solutions.
Okay.
And some of them weren't too brilliant, yeah. But the cryogenics were done at a facility. Must have been 15 or 20 km away from the tracking station.
Right.
So this dry ice and stuff used to be dragged into the station. A lot of fun and a lot of. Well, I can still remember going out occasionally, and as you drove out to this facility, there'd be a number of lampposts on the way out. And in midsummer, every lamppost would be occupied by two or three kangaroos. They'd be in the shadow of the lampposts, and they'd all move up, you know. Jump. So there was lots of interesting little sidelights like that. Well, we went to the cemetery, and just after the entrance to the cemetery, there was a line of graves, small graves. So-and-so, 6 months old, died, you know, and the date. And in those days, the hospital had no air conditioning.
Oh.
So the babies, they'd be born, there'd be no air conditioning, and some of them only lasted, you know, 2 or 3 days. And in the end, that was one of the reasons they actually got air conditioning in the hospital and some of the main buildings up at Woomera. But, you know, there are a whole lot of little historical things like that about how the village grew and what happened and, you know, the sort of people that were there. I remember, you know, we used to have every so often there'd be a get-together out at Woomera West. It was a work camp for some of the blokes that did the roadworks and the antenna stuff and things like that. And they'd have a night in the mess for these people. But, you know, and the Woomera West, if they had a do out there, that was even worse, you know. You could hear it miles away. But, you know, life at Woomera, there was a lot of nightlife to keep, you know, especially for the wives and the kids.
Yeah.
You know, there was not a lot for them to do. The one thing I remember about security is the meat train.
Oh, yes.
I think it was about every fortnight they had a train that came up from Adelaide and it delivered food plus meat to the station. There were a number of, you know, they were about, must have been about 35 miles apart, I think, these stations. And these were the guys, they were staffed by the guys that used to be responsible for looking after the railway tracks.
Ah, okay.
And there were railway tracks down from Woomera.
Yes, through Pimba?
No, that was going out.
Oh, that was going across. Out, okay.
This was going down to, what was the port?
Port Augusta?
Port Augusta, yeah. And the railway sidings. And I know a lot of the people, including my wife, used to go out to meet the meat train because they reckoned it was better than the, than the tucker that was being served by the, was it NASCO or something or other? That was serving the food in the village. So, you know, lots of little perks like that to do things. And we used to have picnics out on the Donga. You know, it'd be nothing like getting out into the middle of nowhere with this marvellous canopy of stars, having a barbecue over burning coals and that sort of thing out in the middle of the Donga. You know, it was, you know, just one of those things that there was quite a good family life. And, you know, they used to have big dances there. The ladies used to get all dolled up in their finery and come out. And I can remember tripping the late fantastic with my dear darling wife and things like that.
Did I see there was a tennis club in town?
Oh, yes. Gee, the tennis club.
Was that a big thing?
Yes. Before I went to Woomera, the church I belonged to had a tennis club. And I learnt what tennis skills they were at the tennis club there at Murrumbina Presbyterian Church. And I was mainly a net player. Didn't mind having the ball slammed damned at me so I could have a go at trying to stop it. But, you know, at the tennis club up there, we had quite a to-do. There were some good tennis players up there. I was only what I would have thought a below-average tennis player, but, yeah.
So back to the station, you tracked a couple of the mariners to Mars, didn't you?
Yeah, I think we did three. There was a lot of lead-up to those missions, you know, training the people on what to expect and tracking and things like that. As station director, I had to get to know lots of noises around inside the tracking station itself.
Yeah.
And I used to come in, open up the entrance door to the area where the control room and all that was, and I'd stand inside and I'd be listening for clicks. And this was the first of the digital tape recorders. And they had a special clicking sound as they did a quick scan of the tape. They got a bit of data, scanned it, and then it'd stop. And I can remember standing there one night. And I'd been there, I suppose I waited about 4 or 5 minutes. And then I went down to the shift director and I said, "How long have you had the problem?" And he looked up, "What problem, boss?" I said, "You have a major problem and you're telling me you don't know about it." "Oh," he said. I said, "You've got 3 minutes to find out what it is." Well, we had a guy there by the name of Ed Renoir.
Oh, yes.
Ed was a brilliant techo, and I can remember he sort of was walking around and he came up and he stood near me and I said, "You don't need to stand near me." He said, "You've been up here for a long while, what's wrong?" And I said, "Well, you just stand here and listen." Oh my gosh. And he dived off. And then there was all hell to pay. And the tape recorders, the shift supervisor and about three other guys all got a bit of a to-do about that one. But we certainly got the act smartened up after that. But Ed Renoir was a top techo. And I can remember on one occasion, I came into the control room and I said something to him. And he went off. And then I remember hearing this funny noise. And I wasn't far and I dived around the corner. And here's Ed jumping up and down. He was as cross as all get up. And I said, "Ed, what's the matter?" He said, "This equipment hasn't been serviced properly." And I suppose within about four minutes, there were three guys up there looking at that equipment and getting it back onto the air. And quite often, you know, something like that was a relatively small problem And, you know, the equipment would be back on the air within about 4 or 5 minutes. And sometimes they lost a whole shift of data from a bit of equipment that they couldn't get back up on the air. But, you know, little interesting episodes like that, which showed the character of some of the people there. But, you know, the standard of the people that we had there and the training that they got, especially if they had to go overseas and get familiar with some equipment, you know, you couldn't fault them most of the time. So, joy to the world.
Yeah, what else can I ask you about? Well, there's Lunar Orbiter, of course. We should talk about Lunar Orbiter. So that was a pretty big and long-running program.
I think there were 6 or 7 of them.
I think there were, and they were all worked pretty well.
Most of them did, yeah.
We turned some amazing photos.
Yes.
Oblique photos looking across the lunar surface.
Yeah.
And but, the first photos of the Earth taken from Lunar Orbiter.
From Lunar Orbiter.
Yeah.
It provided a lot of hours of tracking time for a number of people.
Mm.
It was quite a project. We had, at the tracking station, we peaked at about 185 people. There were typically about 130 on the dish. And then there were the Baikonur camera. I can't remember whether it had 4 or 6 teams of 3 or 4 people. And then the mini-track site, that had 3 or 4 people as well. Might have been more.
And mini-track was moved to Aurora Valley at some point, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was quite a to-do. Because we had a tractor in to recover. The mini track site was a whole lot of wire underground. It was buried. And they had to get the tractor in to pull it all out. So the tractor went along, dragging out all this wire. Wouldn't like to have been the tractor driver, but you win some and you lose some, as I've said. But, you know, there were whole lots of little memories like that.
So when the station was being closed down, I gather once you knew it was being closed down, you couldn't tell the staff straight away because you'd lose staff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Must have been difficult.
Oh, no. No, business as usual.
Yeah.
The staff, we had excellent staff up there. You tried to keep them as informed as you were able. And there were some times you couldn't tell them anything, and other times you could say, this is as far as I can go with the advice. I'd recommend you don't do such and such a thing. Well, you know, it had done its task. More than done the task it was originally designed for. And, you know, people had lots of happy memories about that.
Yeah.
I can remember guys sitting on the edge of the antenna as it was being moved and getting cranky about that. I wasn't supposed to see that. I just happened to be walking past a window at the wrong time. Oh, dear, oh dear.